they had the spiritual directors introduce themselves first before all the participants. And there was like maybe 30 retreatants and 7-8 spiritual directors. And so this woman, I can remember staring right at her across the hall. She stands up. She's like all of about 4'6" or something. Tiny, tiny little gray-haired, old looking nun. And she stands up and she's like, "My name is Sister Ginny Sheehan, and I believe in miracles." And I thought, this is not going to go well. This is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. I'm a child of God and a child of the universe. I am the daughter of Mary and Jim Todd and sister to Jeff and Steve and Katie Todd, aunt to Matthew Todd and Becky and Michael Kurtz. I define myself very much in relation to my family. And in addition, I come from long lineages of ancestors on all of my mother's mothers, my mother's fathers, my father's fathers, my father's mother's line, and many other spiritual lineages. I consider myself primarily a person in relationship to all creatures, human and other than human in the universe, and learning how to be in those relationships as authentically as I can, as rightly and justly as I can. Both of my parents are Methodist, though my father was born Roman Catholic. He's a United Methodist clergy person. And my mother's father was also a Methodist clergy person. So I am a cradle United Methodist, though our upbringing was, I wouldn't say overly religious, despite being raised in a pastor's family. My mother and father, especially in their college days, which was at a Methodist college, Union College in Barbourville, Kentucky, which is where they met, were very much a part of the social gospel tradition of biblical interpretation, which, you know, in the 1950s would have been still pretty early, that critical, historical, analytical understanding of interpreting scriptures. So I grew up in a very liberal, Protestant, mainline household. And my father was a pastor when I was a child, and that transitioned to being the director of a United Methodist Conference and Retreat Center. So much of my childhood was less involved with church than more, though the church Methodist influence was always there. I would say, and what I mean when people ask me, like, what does it mean to be a social justice Christian or whatever, the addition of United Methodism links what's called personal and social holiness. So there is no individual faith per se, aside from your right relationship to the rest of the world. And so personal salvation, so to speak, is less emphasized, and just social relations are equally, or depending on your how deep you are into it, more emphasized. I'm a professor of justice and peace studies at the Iliff School of Theology. So that's something that sort of translated to my adult life as a social justice Christian practitioner. I was also became a United Methodist clergy person. As you may know, I somewhat recently divested of those orders, as now understanding even within the social justice framework of understanding the Christian tradition, the hierarchy implied in Christian theology, as well as the history of oppression, domination, and violence within the Christian tradition was no longer something that I could reconcile myself to. So my spirituality is shifting. Call myself a follower of Jesus and a lover of the Bible, but my theology is shifting much more deliberately to something that embraces the sentience and the holiness of all creation. So struggling with Nonviolence is my PhD dissertation. So in a sense, it had already been written. And I spent however many years, 8 years, 7 years in a PhD program, you know, researching, writing, and putting that out there. It was edited, but it's not something that I had to sit down and write from scratch in order to publish it. It is a research, qualitative research book in which I interviewed 12 veteran activists about the spectrum of violence to nonviolence and their sort of ethical understandings based on their religious and or human ethical understandings of how change happens, you know, really complicated, deep structural social change happens. And in the days that we live in, I don't know that these days are extensively different than the kinds of forms of domination and oppression and violence that we that have been or that will be, but it seemed really appropriate to have the words and the wisdom of those particular 12 elders be out in the world in a way that was more accessible. And then within the context of that, my own interpretation of struggling with nonviolence is not only suggesting that people, generally speaking, might learn to how to be in social struggle using nonviolence, but actually, if you have a commitment and a claim to nonviolence being the kind of social struggle in which you want to engage over against violence, say, the use of different forms of violence, then we need to sort of examine ourselves deeply and internally within ourselves, particularly if we are white people who come from a social location of a fair amount of privilege, racial privilege, class privilege, Christian privilege, sort of examining all of those things for the way in which we might even use nonviolence to hold oppressive social structures in place versus using nonviolence to dismantle, to confront, to disrupt, to destroy the structures, which actually, in fact, then privilege us, because there are still many ways in which people of privilege will use nonviolence to try and pacify and squelch and keep more radical forms of confrontation with oppressive structures, institutional forms of violence at bay. So it's really asking people who believe in nonviolence to struggle with that commitment as a way of holding ourselves accountable for what we say and how we walk in the world. And that nonviolence, if we want to hold it as a means of struggling in the world, has to be investigated just like any other commitment that we have. It's about saying, my life exists within systems of power that both privilege me and in some cases, depending on our identities, also oppress me. And how do I learn to see myself in light of those structures of power and be willing to confront the institutions and the relationships that I have in which I am comfortable in order to shift those power differences or potentially shift those power differences? And it's extremely uncomfortable. It's a weighty book. It's not for fun, but I really want to recommend it to people. And it is probably very Eilifian. It's a very Eilifian book. One story that comes to mind in relation to the word miracle. So totally, it's related, unrelated. So a bit of a yarn. So I'll see how it comes out. And I've never told this story in public. So you'll have an exclusive here. There are many people in my private life who have heard this story, but it's a story that begs to be told in relation to the word miracle. As I mentioned briefly, I was a United Methodist clergy person. I was ordained in 1996 in the Southern New England Conference of the United Methodist Church, and I was appointed as the sole pastor of a church in Lynn, Massachusetts, Christ Church, Christ United Methodist Church. And I want to start by saying that it was the most sacred work I probably have done or will ever do. And I learned so much. And I was so young. I look back now. And they were very patient with me. And we loved each other a lot, I'd like to say. Though it was a church in a former mill town. Lynn, Massachusetts is famous for one of its GE plants. that, you know, at some point in time employed like 30,000 people or something. So by the mid 90s, deindustrialized, you know, a lot of poverty and racism and just a tough, just a lot of the, just like the city I live in now, Lawrence, Massachusetts, economic downturn and just suffering the consequences of globalization and the movement of all local business out to suburbs and white flight and all of these things. I was appointed to this church that had a lot of neglect, I think, that had happened to it. And there was a lot of interpersonal conflict in this church. Financially, it was struggling, of course. I mean, it's like so many small church, United Methodist churches, small Protestant churches, doesn't matter where, right? Struggling with primarily older congregation who had been so faithful to the church and its ongoing existence. And in many ways, sort of always hearkening to the glory of the past when the choir was huge and the Sunday school had 150 kids in it and all this stuff from the 40s and the 50s. And it just wasn't that anymore. And then you have younger, you know, some younger folks coming in, you know, the older people primarily, but not all white, younger people in the neighborhood, you know, not white, a lot of struggle. Say they want to change, say they want to grow, don't really want to grow, don't really want to change. Anybody who's like a clergy person who's listening to this is going to be like, So it's like so many churches, so much change. And I really was, you know, social justice oriented person, a community person. I wanted to be involved in the community. They said they wanted me to be involved in the community, but they kind of were a little like, you're always in the community and you're never here. Just all this to explain that, you know, 2-3 years into it, I was so burned out. I worked constantly, I'm a single person, just, you know, young, don't know my boundaries. Like, I'm not trying to blame anything on anybody. Overachiever, super high functioning. And I really actually was also, you know, raised in seminary to be like, you have to take care of yourself. And I was doing all the things I thought I could possibly do to take care of myself and resting and taking a day off and just anything I could do. And I burned out many, 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 many times. I also drank and smoked a lot of pot, just to be perfectly honest, and had a whole, because I grew up in Massachusetts, so I wasn't too far from all of my high school friends and had like this extended group of people. And I don't want to go so far as to say that I had like a double life, because that's a, like kind of an exaggeration. But, you know, I had my sort of like our pastor doing all the things by day, drinking, smoking a lot of pot with my high school friends at night. Like, I can honestly just tell these stories now. I'd be horrified to think. And I always thought, like, someday I'm going to be totally screwed. I'm going to get pulled over in the city where I'm a pastor. I'm going to be on the police blotter for DUI. Like, I always thought that was going to happen to me, because I was going out and coming home and drinking. And so that's how I coped, especially drinking. And I, at some point in time, I can't even tell you exactly what, like, was this turning point, or I'm just like, I am not okay. I can't get out of the cycle of workaholism. I don't think I have a drinking problem. I don't. This is just what I have to do to cope. And I need to like go away or do something. Like, my friendships, my relationships are in shambles. Like, there's just nothing good going on. And I think I must have heard my own bishop of the United Methodist Church at the time, Susan Hassinger, say something in some context publicly where she would go to this retreat center and spend a long time in silence, and it was her way of rejuvenating. And I thought, that's what I need. Like, it seemed like no amount of self-care could possibly balance out what the kind of I was putting myself through work-wise. I'm like, I need to go on this extensive silent retreat. That'll give me all of this, you know, time and space I need to restore and rejuvenate myself, because I was a mess. Eastern Point Retreat House. I remember I even called the bishop and said, what's the name of the place you go? Tell me about it. I scheduled a retreat. It was in May of 2001. So I literally have no idea what I'm doing. It's a Catholic Jesuit retreat house. I'm going 8 days of silence. I actually had practiced Zen in the past, and I really did have a practice of quiet, but 8 days of silence was a lot. And I show up at this beautiful retreat house. It's in Gloucester, Massachusetts. It's on the coast, rocky, typical New England. When you think of like Maine with the lighthouse and all of that, it was in Massachusetts, just like that. Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. And all I know is that when I get to the retreat house, I'm going to have 8 days of silence and two other things happen. You have a spiritual director who's assigned to you that you meet for 30 days. And you have worship, Catholic mass, every day in the evening. So these would be like the only two places in which you really like have voice or talk to someone, or like in mass, you sing and all these kinds of things, listen to a homily. I'm not Catholic, again, I'm Methodist. So I've never had this kind of experience before. I go to the retreat center. And just before sort of like the very first thing that happens, you go to your room and there's this little piece of paper that says, your spiritual director is, and then they write in the person's name. And it says, Virginia Ginny Sheehan. Actually, I think it said Sister Virginia Ginny Sheehan. So I know my person's name. And then you go into this big hall and everyone introduces themselves, and all the spiritual directors and all the priests who live at this Jesuit center introduce themselves, including ourselves. And then once you're done introducing yourselves, you go deep into the silence. So I can remember the hall. It was like chairs that were facing each other in rows. And they had the spiritual directors introduce themselves first before all the participants. And there was like maybe 30 retreatants and 7-8 spiritual directors. And so this woman, I can remember staring right at her across the hall. She stands up. She's like all of about 4'6" or something. Tiny, tiny little gray-haired, old looking nun. And she stands up and she's like, my name is Sister Ginny Sheehan, and I believe in miracles. And I thought, this is not going to go well. This is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. I can't believe that I got the miracle lady. Like, this is such BS. I cannot believe I got this pint-sized little whoever, Catholic nun, who's going to be the miracle lady. I was pissed. I was like, all right, whatever. I guess as I got Sister Ginny. So Sister Ginny. Sister Ginny turned out to be straight up spiritual warrior. Okay. So despite this flowery, almost like cute miracle language, she was really something else. There's a lot of stories I could tell about those 8 days. And I'm going to just try and focus really on the end, because that's the punchline. But what I'll say about some of those days is that I had some tremendous, tremendous, tremendous embodied experience of God's love, in which, for example, God took possession of my hands and caressed my face and told me that God loved me. In which, when I wanted to escape, I convinced myself on the Sunday, you got there on like a Thursday, by Sunday, I'm like practically out of my mind because I've been quiet for 3 days and I want to escape from myself and know something's happening to me and I don't know what, but something's happening. And I decide that I'm going to get in my car on a Sunday morning and go to a Methodist church to worship, which was the stupidest idea because there's probably nothing more I could have gotten out of the local United Methodist Church worship service than I could have gotten at this retreat center. I got in my car and I turned it on and I heard the words in my mind or my heart inside of myself that said, don't go. God, I was so mad. I banged on my steering wheel and I was like, I want to go, you know, like I just wanted to get away from myself. So these are the kinds of experiences I had, these experiences of just God being like with me, on top of me, like knowing what I needed in every minute. Those would just be two examples of like very significant interventions of God in my life, trying to keep me in place to tell me something I needed to know. And now we're on day 7. Night 7, really, and we're at mass, right? So you had mass at night, you met your spiritual director during the day, and you had mass at like 5:00, right before dinner. And I'm at mass, and I don't know why, but I'm crying so uncontrollably, I cannot even live with myself. Like, I don't have any idea what's going on. I know I'm going home the next day, but I don't know what's wrong with me. but I am just openly weeping throughout the whole thing, which is not like me. Like, I'm a pretty reserved Yankee. Like, you know, I'm not crying in public much, just weeping in public. So after Mass, Sister Ginny walks up to me and she's like, "What's wrong with you?" And by now I realize, like, she's no joke, right? She's the Miracle Lady, but she's no joke. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm just crying. I literally am completely out of control. No idea. She says, "I want you to go into the Mary Chapel," which was a chapel I had prayed in a lot. It's facing the ocean. There's a statue of Mary there. She's holding Jesus, child, you know, one of these typical Jesus things. "I want you to go in the Mary Chapel. And I want you to get on your knees and ask God what's wrong with you." And I was like, "I don't want to." And she was like, "I want you to go into the Mary Chapel and get on your knees and ask God what's wrong with you." I was like, okay. You know, like, so she's like, "And so you're going to do this. And then it's time for dinner. You're going to go to dinner. And then you're going to meet me in XYZ room after dinner. And you're going to tell me what God said." I was like, okay. She's like, "You promise me you're going to get on your knees in that room. You're going to go eat dinner. You're going to come to the XYZ room. And you're going to tell me what God told you." Like, okay. So I did. I went to the Mary Chapel. I got on my knees. And it didn't take long. I calmed myself down a little bit. And I said, "God, what's wrong with me?" And I hear, "You have a substance abuse problem." And I was just like, and I knew it was true, but even so, I was like, "Can I hear that again?" Just to confirm. I was like, "Oh my God." And I had this, like, in a sense, like, kind of a weight lift off me. Like, I just knew it was true, even though, like, I hadn't talked to Sister Ginny about drinking, about smoking pot, about my high school friends, literally nothing, none of that. I don't even know what I talked to her about. So, but I'm like, "Oh my God, what is this information?" And then I go and I eat and I know that I have to go tell her. So I go, we sit in the room. I mean, she wastes no time. She's like, "What did God tell you?" And I was like, "I don't know." She's like, "What did God tell you?" I was like, "I think I have a substance abuse problem." And as soon as I said that, like, this huge weight lifted off of me. And she said, she leaned really close to me. It was a very small room. And she's like, "I know what your problem is." I was like, "You know what my problem?" I just told you what my problem is. She's like, "No, I know what your problem is. I know what your problem is." I was like, "Why are you freaking me out? I think I just told you what my problem is." She's like, "Here's what your problem is." And so I'm sitting back. I'm like, all wide-eyed. And what? She's freaking me out. Like, she's being super aggressive again. And she says, "You go to your little church every morning. You have this long list of things to do that you know you're not going to accomplish. You're feeling the stress of the day. You go to your office. You talk to your secretary. She tells you 6 things you don't want to hear. You sit in your office all day long trying to get 2 things done in your list. Everybody's coming into your office, interrupting you all day with all their problems. And you have, you know, the end of the day, you know, kind of getting to the end of the day. You realize you haven't eaten anything. You go across the street, get a sub, come back in, you work while you're eating, you go to the finance committee meeting at night, all they do is fight, they blame everything on you. At the end of the day, you literally have not done 4 things on your list of 29,000 things. You walk out to your car, you turn the key, before you put it in drive, you tell yourself, "I can't wait to have a drink." I was like, I don't think I told her any of that. I'm like, it was like the exact description of my day. I mean, I'm sure I had told her about my day and I probably had told her that I drank at night. I don't remember. And she says, and I was like, "You're freaking me out. That's exactly how my day goes." She's like, do you know why I know what your problem is? I was like, "No, God, you're freaking me out. I don't know why you know what my problem is." She was like, "I know why what your problem is because I'm 17 years sober. And if I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but if you go home tomorrow, because tomorrow was the last day, right? If you go home tomorrow and drink, you're going to die. And I don't know if you're going to die tomorrow, or you're going to die in 10 years from now, or you're going to die a spiritual death that tortures you to the end of your days. But if you're an alcoholic and you go home tomorrow and you drink, you're going to die. I was like, oh my God. I mean, she just knew. She had like one shot at me. She's like, so she's like, I want you to go back in that Mary Chapel on your knees all night long under the moonlight with Mary and ask God to help you stay sober for the rest of your life. So, which is what I did. And she's like, I want you to meet me tomorrow. There's the last thing we do is have mass at like noon, and then you leave. And I want to talk to you before you leave. I did. I spent my night crying on my knees in the Mary Chapel. I, you know, had mass, walked up to her, and she said, she said two things. I have your phone number. I just want you to know I have your phone number from your application. And sometime within the next year, I'm not telling you when, I'm going to call you at your home and ask you if you've had a drink. I was like, okay. So she took me by, put her hands on both of my shoulders, stood right in her 4 foot nothing frame, looked right up at me and said, see, you're a miracle. I was like, oh my God. And I had judged her, you know, that right from the day one. I was like, miracles, what a bunch of crap. And she's like, see, you're a miracle. And I haven't drank since then. And my 20th anniversary of my sobriety is May 9th, 2021. And that's my miracle story, Kirsten.
Yes, with this amazing interview, we've reached episode 40 of Bite-Sized Blessings, a podcast all about the magic and spirit that surrounds us, if only we open our eyes to it. And whether you choose to listen to our bite-sized offerings for that 5 to 10 minutes of freedom in your day, or the longer interviews, we're grateful you're here. I need to thank my wonderful guest, Dr. Julie Todd, for sharing her story today, as well as the creators of the music used, Chilled Music, Sasha End, Agnes Vomagia, Lilo Sound, and Kevin McLeod. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you can find links to other episodes, to art, books, and people who are making this world a better and more beautiful place. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Julie. Ask the hard questions. What's wrong with me? What do I need to fix? And then be ready for the answers, whether they come in large or small packages.